This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. Today on Dreamland, we're going down what I regard as a very, very important path. We're going to be talking about spirituality in a very new way in the context of archetypes and the three stages of initiatic spirituality. We'll be talking to Angel Millar. He's a well-known lecturer on Freemasonry, initiation, and esotericism. He's an artist and a student of the martial arts, and there's going to be some fascinating discussion of some really deep material about martial arts in this show. He's the author of a number of books, including Freemasonry, Foundation of the Western Esoteric Tradition. He lives here in the United States in New York City. Angel, I'd like to welcome you to Dreamland.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Of his book, The Three Stages of Initiatic Spirituality, Mitch Horowitz, who is a frequent guest on Dreamland and, of course, the editor of both Solving the Communion Enigma, the republication of The Key, and Supernatural, the book I wrote with Jeffrey Kripal, says this of Angel Millar: he is among a golden handful of writers who authentically and practically bridge the gap between primeval wisdom and modern spirituality. Within the triad of ancient and mythical archetypes of the three stages of initiatic spirituality, you will discover your true self. Angel's book will make you stronger, sturdier, and more learned. And Angel, boy, do we need that in this particular era.
Yeah, we're in quite a fix, I think, or quite a time.
Well, what a time, yes. It's not just interesting times. It's extremely interesting times, God help us.
Yes, yeah, right.
I want to start, in view of Mitch's comment, with Homo heidelbergensis around 450,000 years ago and an axe. Can you begin by telling us about that?
Really, at the beginning of human evolution, you find that there's a lot of axes being created, and they're not normal axes. Obviously, normal axes were created, but a few million years ago, the earliest type of human beings were creating these extremely oversized axes that really couldn't be used practically. And they were often made of stone. And even where I come from in England, in a local little suburb, from thousands and thousands of years ago, they've also found similar axes, although of a much later day, but still very ancient. And one of them was made of a green stone, and they've also been found in other types of stone as well, I believe in rose quartz. And, you know, obviously you can't use a rose quartz axe practically or a green stone axe practically. So it seems that there was some sort of initiatic or spiritual significance to these axes that they were producing. And it definitely indicates that there's some kind of spiritual, maybe not tradition, but some kind of spiritual understanding or metaphysical understanding, and which in a way goes quite against the popular conception of ancient people being sort of people that can barely speak or think beyond that of the lowest animal. Clearly, there was something much more sophisticated going on. But if we go into the ancient past, but you know, a couple of thousand years ago or less, you do find the axe and the hammer turning up again as really significant implements in mythology. Thor's hammer being probably the best known, and in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, you also have the Vajra, the diamond thunderbolt as well, which has similar significance to Thor's hammer. And even today in the Masonic Lodge, the Masonic gavel or hammer also has some significance as well. So,
Free Dreamlanders, we're going to take a very brief break right now. And when we come back, we're going to explore the most basic reality here, which is the reality of archetypes. We'll be right back. There aren't going to be any of our usual commercials in this edition of Dreamland. Obviously, things are pretty tough right now, and I have a couple of thoughts for you. First, if you can't afford to subscribe to unknowncountry.com, we desperately need you, and this is the time to step up, just bluntly. If you would like to listen to more and can't afford a subscription, send a request to subscribers@unknowncountry.com, and we can let you listen free to the whole show, at least for a period of time. But if you can afford it, please, please, please go to unknowncountry.com and click on the subscribe tab and get started. We're talking to Angel Millar. His book, The Three Stages of Initiatic Spirituality, Craftsman, Warrior, Magician. Now, Angel, we are going to get into craftsman in just a minute, but I think it's quite important first to talk a little bit about something that nobody ever thinks about anymore, which is memory. We don't use our memories. They're atrophying.
Because of
the world we live in. Can you tell us a little bit about the esoteric significance of memory?
Sure. And just piggybacking on what you were saying about our memories atrophying, of course, in recent decades in particular, there's been a real backlash against the idea of quote unquote rote memory and in education. And, you know, certainly you don't want an education that's all just memorizing, but memorization has been a really, really significant part of human culture and every human culture, actually, for thousands, if not tens of thousands of years. And, you know, even today, you're regarded as a really kind of privileged figure within Islam if you have memorized the whole of the Quran, and children in at least in some cultures within Islam would be encouraged to learn the entirety of the Quran by memory. And, you know, you find this in other cultures as well, of course. So within Hinduism or Sanatana Dharma, the Brahmins would memorize the whole of the Vedas. Only later were they recorded in writing. And, you know, most cultures had oral traditions. And again, going forward into our own time, even Freemasonry was pretty much an oral tradition for the first few decades. And that's why if you see a Masonic ritual in one state in the U.S. or within one country, you find that there are actually differences, and that's because they've been memorized a little bit differently. Sometimes they've been changed over time as well, but the memorization was a big part of it. So memorization really underlies most sophisticated cultures, at least in their ancient past, whether it's Hindu or Islamic or something else, but Buddhism as well. There's also an element of memorization, and you know, memorization makes you familiar with your culture. So there's always going to be some degree of memorization, I think, in ancient past and in initiations, and some of that. Some of that is technical. Maybe you have to memorize a ritual or memorize some mythology, but the more advanced members of the society, the Brahmin, the priest, would be, in a sense, the gatekeepers of oral traditions and oral knowledge, and really memorizing the canon of that society, which is really the kind of metaphysics of what that society is based on and what its assumptions are. And But I do also discuss the idea of a memory beyond, in a sense, our current time. And if we look at the different mythologies of the ancient past, Hinduism, for example, talks about the different ages. And in the beginning, there was the Satva Yuga, which was the golden age. And then it has declined and declined, and we're now in the Kali Yuga, or the Iron Age, the Age of Materialism, and of in a sense of disharmony and even chaos, and of the family being destroyed, and corrupt people being elevated to leadership roles, and the intelligent people and spiritual people who want a more natural lifestyle being sort of downtrodden, or at least not having much of a role in society. And so rituals, in a certain sense, reorientate us away from the chaos of the current age, or the materialism of the current age, and reorientate the initiate towards what is beyond that and before that, which is the golden age. So it kind of gives him a glimpse of a glimpse of the harmony of the golden age, when everything was allegedly in harmony, man with nature, nature with the deity, and deity with man, essentially. And it reorientates him towards, in a sense, through his own death, but by trying to get him to, in a sense, create his own golden age within whichever age he might find himself, including in the Kali Yuga or the Iron Age, and to act in a way that makes going towards death and through death possible, and also to reunite with the creator on the other side, as it were, if I can put it like that.
Yeah, I understand that very well. And I want to ask you, what can people do with this? Because, you know, I had a very extraordinary thing happen in 2015, in January of 2015. Long before my wife passed away in August of that same year, she began wanting me to memorize a poem by W.B. Yeats, Song of the Wandering Angus. And she was really adamant about it. And when I couldn't memorize it, I'm not good at memorization. Most of us aren't anymore.
No.
And she cried. And I really worked after that. After she passed away, it turned out that it was of absolutely central importance to understanding the meaning of her return, which happened, the meaning of my own life, and the symbology of her return. So I found that very powerful. And since then, I have thought of memory as sacred.
And
what can we do? We who mostly are outside of the context of memory. We don't memorize.
Yeah.
Do you have any suggestions that we might use to, in this regard?
Yeah. It's definitely a tricky thing to approach, but I think one thing that we can do is to try to get an understanding of ancient cultures and of their sort of spiritual understanding, that their metaphysics, and to see how they are in some senses they're very different, in other senses they're very similar, and to see in which ways they may have been similar, and in which ways that this sort of more ancient and, frankly, more holistic understanding can actually help us today. And even by doing that, you probably will be remembering different aspects of the mythology as you make connections with other mythologies. I mentioned the similarity between the Thor, the hammer of Thor, and the Tibetan Vajra, for example. And so I think just by immersing yourself in a serious study of mythology and symbolism, you can at least have some kind of foundation for this kind of memory of the golden age, in a way. It's something that will reorientate you, at least away from crass materialism.
Free Dreamlanders, we're taking another brief break. We'll be back with Angel Millar in just a moment. I do hope, if you can afford it, you see your way to subscribing to unknowncountry.com. But even if you don't do that, One of the most uplifting books I've ever written is The Afterlife Revolution, which breaks through into a completely new vision of the afterlife. I co-authored it with my wife, Anne, after she died. And I would like to add that my experience of the unusual and the unknown is one of the most witnessed in history, including that. Anne came back, but in such a way that it was really very hard to deny, unless you just can't stand the idea of an afterlife. So go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever you basically buy books and take a look at The Afterlife Revolution. If ever there was a time when this book would offer strength, now is that time. We're talking to Angel Millar, and before we go on, I'd like to ask him, Angel, or ask you, Angel, about your experience of Masonry.
I'll just say that I joined in 2001, and just to dispel one myth or one rumor straight away, it's often believed that you have to be asked to join, and otherwise you cannot. And actually, for many years up until recently, you actually had to ask to join. So it was actually the opposite. And I had always grown up with the assumption that you had to be sort of picked. And then I happened to read a biography of one ceremonial magician, I believe associated with the Golden Dawn. I can't remember who it was, but I read that he had gone into the Grand Lodge in England and asked to become a member. And when I moved to New York, I did the same thing. I went to the Grand Lodge of New York and asked if I could become a member. And it was a bit of a process, but basically I was given an introduction to it and met with different members. But for me, it's been quite an experience. I certainly appreciate the initiatic rituals that I've experienced, which are loosely based on the initiation rituals of the Stonemasons Guild of Great Britain, and there's evidence for the early sort of more primitive versions of these initiatic rituals from the 1600s, so around 400 years ago. And then during the early 1700s, they were elaborated when Freemasonry had really become its own society, pretty much detached from the Stonemasons Guild at that point. But I've definitely appreciated these initiatic rituals. It's very difficult in our own age to really experience any kind of initiation ritual. And going through an initiation was really something that every man in probably every culture at one point experienced as a marking point from boyhood into adulthood. And, it's certainly true that Freemasons typically are probably a little older than that. They're certainly not in their teens anymore. Early 20s would be the earliest. But nevertheless, it is an experience that is akin to initiatic experiences of different cultures around the world. And in the rituals, you're shown various symbols. You experience the lodge for the first time. It's a sort of theatrical play, much of it, but very sort of atmospheric. Beyond that, what I personally appreciated is that I've been able to do a lot of research. And although the Masonic libraries typically are open to the public, for me, because I was a researcher, I was able to get really unlimited access, including to some very ancient or at least very, very old books and manuscripts. So that has been invaluable as well.
Your book certainly reflects that. It is the deepest dive into this I've ever read. And it's so well done.
Thank you. Thank you.
So well done. It's really, really solid research, folks. And, you can gain a lot from this. I personally had an initiatic experience with the visitors in 1988. Before the show, we spoke briefly about it, and I didn't think I would bring it up, but I will bring it up because it was a moment of, I had, series of nine knocks, three knocks in three sets on the side of my house, and there's no question about it that it was not an ordinary experience. No trees, branches, or anything like that. It was quite a real experience, and I regarded it as an initiatory moment. And I think that subsequently, what I've learned in my communication with them is that there is a very craft-oriented aspect to their whole inner journey as well. So I thought that was, and it's just like their method of communication is similar to that in the Gurdjieff work that I was in and have been in all my life, all my adult life anyway. So we're dealing here with something that has definitely got echoes in at a cosmic level outside of the human context. Now, and you know, I ask myself always, why don't we remember what's wrong here? And you say in the book, as we have suggested, the symbols of the lineage and its initiations are vague memories of the golden age and our descent from it, and sometimes what preceded it. And there is this powerful sense of that. In my relationship with the visitors, there is a real sense that they have not descended from that level of knowledge. Can you talk about this descent? What happened, do you think?
Yeah, it's I don't have any theories about why we've descended. I know there's obviously there's the notion of the flood in particular and the destruction of mankind and of a more advanced race of human beings before that, and certainly there are hints of that in different religions and different traditions, of course, all over the world, the destruction of Atlantis or something close to that. In Freemasonry, you have a little glimpse of that as well. And in the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, you have that with their sort of their attempt to kind of return to the kind of primordial state of the Garden of Eden as well. And obviously the Garden of Eden would be another sort of not advanced civilization, but another idea of the golden age prior to the destruction and the introduction of death and disease and corruption and so on. Just to mention one thing in Freemasonry, where you do find this in the earliest mythologies, which are part of the Stonemasons Guild, the earliest existing record of this mythology is from around 1400 AD, so it's about 600 years old. And Freemasonry emerged around 1717, so it's a few hundred years before that. There was a mythology that was recorded over the centuries by the Stonemasons, and it explained how stonemasonry came from ancient Egypt and ancient Greece into Great Britain. A lot of it is very strange. But it talks about the blacksmith Tubal making these two different columns and writing all of the arts and sciences on it that they knew. And in the hope that if God sent destruction by a flood or by fire, that one of these pillars at least would remain, and so that the future generations that emerged after the catastrophe would have these arts and sciences. And again, you find in Freemasonry talking about a memory of the symbols being a memory of this archaic time or this golden age. In Freemasonry, there's also two pillars, but there's no real conscious connection between the two, but there's obviously a historical connection between the mythology and the old charges that they were recorded in and the later Masonic lodge and its structure. But I don't know if it was because of a flood or some other catastrophe or just because of the human notion of progress, which is often just completely out of control and just thinks that more and more technology is progress somehow and doesn't really think about what the technology might be doing, and often doesn't seem really to care. But clearly we have descended from a point where we've been relatively in harmony with nature and with our own bodies to a point where we're completely, almost completely disenfranchised from nature and from our own bodies and from the sort of natural harmony that one would have living in a natural environment, eating natural food, getting regular exercise and air, and having some kind of sense of the sacred as well, which is often lost today.
That sense of the sacred is so difficult to recover, and
yeah,
that it, and it, yet it's so terribly important. Now, Free Dreamlanders, we're going to take another little break. I think our next to the last one, if not our last one, I'll find out later. And we'll be back in a moment with Angel Millar, and we're going to be talking about the archetypes and what they are, and how they are a way in to this other level of living and being. We'll be right back. I'm going to extend the appeal to subscribe to unknowncountry.com. A subscription offers so much more. There is a huge archive that is really worth exploring. Many of the shows are literally unique in the world, and you can gain access not only to Dreamland, to all of our other shows, the Revelation Show of William Henry, Anne Streber's lovely Mysterious Powers, Jeremy Vaney's equally mysterious The Experience, and of course, our current shows, Mia Ferraletto's New Observations and Mike Clellan's The Unseen. There is so much there. There are also meditations there from me. There is a discussion of the key. There are audiobooks, the Majestic audiobook, the Secret School audiobook, the Transformation audiobook, and others. So don't miss out on unknowncountry.com. And if you would like to join but can't afford to right now, write subscribers at unknowncountry.com, and we will give you a period of free access. But if you can't afford it, believe me, now is the time. Please come to be with us. We're talking to Angel Millar, the three stages of initiatic spirituality. You can find him on the internet by simply Googling the words Angel Millar, M-I-L-L-A-R. And if you go to any of the book websites, like Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any of them, just put his name in, Angel Millar, M-I-L-L-A-R, and all of his work will come up. Now, what are archetypes? What are they?
Yes, well, in a sense, they are the primordial characters that reappear across time and in different cultures, and that's why you do find similarities between one religion and another, or one culture and another, at least in ancient times. And yes, I think that's the for me, that's basically what an archetype is. There have been many. Different sort of families of archetypes that have been put together over the years and presented as ways of understanding ourselves psychologically. There's actually a group of 12 archetypes, quote unquote, that are used in marketing. So the marketer will say, okay, which archetypes does our customer fit? I would say that, from what I've seen, those archetypes are more like character traits, so they're not really archetypes, as I understand them, or as Carl Jung might have understood them, or anybody involved with spirituality might understand them. But I focus on the craftsman, warrior, and magician, because according to philologist George Dumézil, who was very well known and influential in the 20th century, he claimed that Indo-European society a few thousand years ago, was structured with these three archetypes. So each tribe of the Indo-European society or each culture within it would have a craftsman making the tools and making implements that you need to survive, and obviously, you know, growing food and so on. And then you had the warriors who would maybe do hunting, but would certainly be defending the culture or the tribe. And then the magicians or the holy men or the spiritual elders or the Brahmins of that society. But I think, beyond the Indo-European society, you pretty much find those three vocations or archetypal vocations in every culture. And I doubt you could really have a sustaining and flourishing culture without those three, at least in ancient society. So that's why I focus on those three. And there is a belief as well that at least in the very ancient past, men in particular would have started out their life after childhood as a craftsman, and then moved into becoming a warrior for the tribe when their body matured and they became adult men. And then later on, as their body was weakening with age, then they would become the magician or the spiritual guide or the elder or the guide in general for the society. And, it should just be noted, of course, that people started life working at a very young age. People of 2,000-3,000 years ago or more or less even were not going to university until 25, 30. They were probably, helping their parents out in the field or in the forge or whatever their parents were doing to as part of the society working. They were helping their parents at, 4 or 5 or 6 at the latest, and then becoming more and more of a worker as their body grew.
So these archetypes are very different from the sort of energetic presences that someone like Jung would identify as archetypes. That's what you're saying. Is that correct?
There's definitely a link to Jung's ideas. I mean, especially once you get into the realm of deities, and which deities would represent the craftsman or the warrior or the magician. So, for example, Thor seems to have some relation to the blacksmith. He carries a hammer which glows red hot and sparks come out of his beard and so on. So he seems to represent the blacksmith archetype, and Odin might represent potentially the warrior archetype or the magician archetype. He really has kind of all three in one. But I think when you look at the actual cultures and the vocations themselves, they're definitely archetypal. They're definitely sort of manifesting the very basic things that human society needs to flourish or to sustain itself. But there's definitely a relationship to different ideas of gods, which Jung would conceive of as being archetypes.
And the power of these archetypes can be definitely used for good or evil. There's a painting in the Staatsmuseum of Art in Munich called The Wild Hunt by Franz Stuck. And if you look at it, it's a picture of Wodan and his wild hunt. And the image is strikingly similar, the face, to that of Adolf Hitler. And the reason is Hitler copied that look on purpose in order to identify himself with the power of the archetype.
Right, right. Yeah, so in my book, I try to give these sort of metaphysical background of each of these archetypes, so that, the rituals that are associated with the craftsman or the warrior or the magician, some symbols, mythology, and so on. And so, I definitely think that learning those are very valuable, or at least learning about those things are very valuable. At the end of the book, I do give some suggestions on how to kind of embody each of these things. And, and again, I mentioned that these archetypes are really at the foundation of all ancient cultures, which, of course, we are ourselves are founded on ultimately. But But even much later, you find these three archetypes being represented in different philosophical and other traditions. So Plato, for example, said that education should be founded on music, which is obviously the craftsman, on wrestling, which would be the warrior, and on philosophy, which would be the magician or the spiritual guide or elder. So again, he's almost re-embodying these ancient archetypes in a way that was suitable for his time, that you could find them again in his time. And if you look at someone like the famed samurai Miyamoto Musashi, again, obviously he was a warrior and he was the most feared and renowned warrior of his day, a samurai. But he's also famous in Japan, and certainly during his lifetime, but even now, he's famous for his calligraphy and painting, which would be the craftsman again. And then for landscape gardening. And obviously he wrote the Book of Five Rings and is supposed to have meditated in a cave for 10 years and so on. So, again, he represents the embodiment of these three archetypes in one. And I recommend trying to take up some kind of practice. One of the big problems that we face today in the world is that no matter what job we have, even if it's quite a good job, we're almost guaranteed not to be creating the whole of anything. You might be creating the whole of something. So if you work on a car, for example, maybe you're responsible for the tires. Someone else might be responsible for cleaning the interior and so on, but no one's going to be responsible for designing the whole of anything or manufacturing the whole of anything usually. And so I think this is very psychologically bad for us, that we are, in a sense, we're all what the apparel industry would have called piece workers a few decades ago, that we just create a piece of something over and over again, and we never create the whole of anything, which means we never see the process of the creative process through from beginning to end. And I think that psychologically is at the very least unfulfilling process. Partly to try and embody these three archetypes, I recommend that people take up some kind of art or craft. And maybe ideally for me, that would be something like painting or writing, if you're really going to dedicate yourself to it, or poetry. There's a big link between poetry and the martial arts as well. But if you really can't take up one of those, maybe I would recommend taking up just learning to cook. And, you asked me earlier on about how do we get back in touch with this memory. And actually, one thing I didn't say, but I can say it now, and that is, I really recommend that people get in touch with their own traditions and really start to learn about that. And try to find what's good in it and really try to respect what's valuable in it. And that might mean learning mythology, but another very practical way is to just take up cooking and cook the food that you grew up with or cook the food of your culture. It's probably going to be better for your body, but it's also going to start bringing back actual memories of your childhood as well and actual memories of your culture. And cultures are kind of they are holistic in a way that there's a kind of language that goes on in a culture, and it's you find it in food, but you would also find it in painting or the arts and in other things as well, like clothing or architecture. And so, if you look at traditional Japanese culture, you can see that there's kind of a link between the print work of medieval Japan, for example, where it's like bold colors and black outlines. You can see there's a relationship there between, say, that and sushi. There's some kind of mental connection, and this kind of minimalism again that you find in both of those, you find in their architecture as well. And, it's a part of the psyche. And in the West, you might say there's, quite a big link between, say, our food. And then if you look at a painting by Turner or Constable. There's some kind of aesthetic similarity. And again, if you look at the architecture and the landscape of Great Britain or Europe, you know, there's a definite similarity there. There's some kind of language that's being spoken in all these different realms. So, you know, so one very practical way of rediscovering this memory, which might not be an ancient or archetypal memory, but at least is going in that direction, is to just learn the food of your own culture. And certainly to get away from buying prepackaged food or always eating out at a restaurant, which is really unhealthy. So I recommend definitely doing that. You'll improve your body. That's going to be very good for you. And you'll start to get in contact with your own culture and appreciate it. And then with the warrior, I definitely recommend taking up a martial art and some kind of self-defense. Those two are not always identical. So you always have to be mindful that you might be practicing a martial art, but it might not be practical for self-defense in all situations. So that's just something to be mindful of. But ideally, practicing a martial art and self-defense, at the very least, practicing some kind of strength training or physical training that's going to, especially for men, to build up your muscles a little bit, maybe give you a bit of a better posture and some more confidence in yourself as well. And as for the magician, I recommend a range of things, you know, learning about ancient cultures and mythologies and reading ancient texts if you can, whether it's the Poetic Edda or the Bible or the Tao Te Ching or the Analects of Confucius. They've nearly always got something important to say, at least in, you know, maybe not in every passage, but in much of those books, you'll find enough insights into life to help you through life and its vicissitudes. And I also recommend, you know, taking up a practice of meditation as well. And maybe if you're more religious, taking up some kind of religious practice, making sure you like meditate or pray every day or performing some ritual every day. In Hinduism, there's puja, of course, where you make some kind of offering to the god and so on. So to just try and balance those three archetypes, practicing an art, practicing some kind of physical training, and some kind of spiritual practice such as meditation.
And do you have any particular recommendations? For example, you have a number of meditations in the book. Could you give us an idea of your view of what meditation is and how to use it?
Yeah. Well, for me, there's definitely different types of meditation. And I suppose ultimately what you're trying to do is to get your entire life to be more meditative, where you're sort of more conscious, but also of things, but more calm as well. And obviously that's something that takes practice, and it's not easy, especially in this time that we're living in. At the time we're recording, we're locked down, and there's, you know, paranoia about viruses and then paranoia about the government locking everything down. You know, it's not an easy time to be alive, probably. But in terms of actual specific practices of meditation, I myself practice chakra meditation, where I'm meditating on the chakras, which are different points in the body, to try and sort of generate and cultivate what's called inner energy. You should probably do that under a teacher if you're going to do that, but that's something that I do. It's often a part of martial arts. It can be a part of yoga as well. It's part of Taoist inner alchemy. But beyond that, you know, there's also the more basic practice of just sitting down and trying to relax, but keep your body sort of upright but relaxed, and just focusing on your breath in and out, and just letting go of the thoughts that are kind of plaguing you, and just relax. And so I do that as well. And another meditation I mentioned in the book, as you know, is meditating on your own mortality. That's definitely something that different cultures have practiced during the Black Death in Europe. Actually, there was an entire kind of practice called Memento Mori, and it was formulated in a couple of books, and it was basically about how to not only how to live well, but how to die well as well. And obviously it was related to the Christian religion. And there's actually a Catholic monk who's revived that practice as well. Very recently. But meditation on death is, or at least meditation on your own mortality, we're not going to be here forever, is, you find that in most most religious and spiritual traditions, whether it's walking into a church where you see Jesus on the cross, or the samurai manual, with the Hagakura suggests that the samurai should meditate upon being killed in various ways and imagine himself dying in various horrible ways every day to get kind of used to the idea, but also to get used to the idea that we're not going to live forever. And the idea is not to be macabre and morbid and think, woe is me, but quite the opposite, to think, you know, this time is important and I shouldn't waste it. And you know, a lot of people are very content to waste their lives, unfortunately, but realizing that time is finite generally makes people take action for the better.
I have witnessed a person enact a conscious death. My wife Anne did this. She began very consciously in January of 2015, not without telling me, to prepare for her death. And she enacted it in late July and early August of that year, finally passing on August the 11th. And it was a really remarkable experience for me, certainly by far the hardest experience of my life, and at the same time, the most valuable, because Annie had a near-death experience in 2005 and was not afraid of death at all. Not at all. And subsequently, in her afterlife, she expertly enacted A Return, which became the book The Afterlife Revolution, and is still very much with me to this day. What I learned from her during this period is that if you absolutely are not afraid of death, you can make it part of the craft of your life. Instead of putting it off and pretending it's not going to happen, it becomes a goal. And it's quite an extraordinary way of changing your experience of being alive.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I don't want to quote Steve Jobs as any kind of guru or anything like that, but I always find it interesting.
He was much too mean to be a guru.
Yes, apparently so. But he did say one really interesting thing. And as he said, though, when he was about 16, he came across this little slogan, and he said, I think I forgot what he said exactly, but basically, what would you do if this was the last day of your life? And he said that from then on, every day, he thought, what is what I'm doing today what I would want to do if it's the last day of my life, because it's going to come. And if it wasn't, then he would change his life after, if he said no for enough days in a row. So, you know, I'm sure that that's part of his success, that he was always thinking about, well, if this was the end, is this what I would want to be doing? Whereas, you know, many people are forced, in a sense, to just endure not a very exciting life. But a lot of people also maybe don't want to feel that they can take action and just allow themselves to kind of drift through life because they don't really want to think about death and the end. It's sort of like this permanent, it feels like a permanent state that they're in, but actually it's not, because
right, that illusion of permanence is something we all have to work on. How do you respond to that when I ask you, what is to be done? What do we do in our lives?
Well, I would just return to the point we were making earlier of trying to embody these three archetypes. And it's not just, you know, it's not just that these were the archetypes that sustained cultures in ancient time, and that the people that inhabited them progressed through them from craftsman warrior to magician or spiritual elder. And it's not just that we find them again reflected in Plato's idea of education, embodying these three, or the samurai, or so on. But it's also that, you know, we're not one-dimensional figures. We're told in this day and age that we need to specialize and we need to find a niche, And we need to find a niche within a niche, and we need to find the smallest thing and focus on it. And that's our life. And actually, we're all bigger than that. And we're all capable of things that we can't believe right now. And one way to really become who we should be is to focus on these different aspects of ourselves and to cultivate them, whether it's cultivating an art or some kind of skill that you can see through from beginning to end, cultivating the body and getting stronger, and cultivating some kind of spiritual, philosophical practice as well. And, you know, if you do that and dedicate yourself to that a little bit each day, extraordinary things will happen over time, given enough time.
The next two archetypes are the warrior and the magician. And now the only listeners left, and there are quite a lot of them, thank goodness, are many of them quite advanced in their understanding of esoteric traditions. And so you can really speak as deeply as you want to. And I was, I thought that your, all three of the archetypes are addressed in such a deeply knowledgeable and intelligent way here. I would like to relate them to life. In other words, tell us about the warrior archetypes, and let's talk a little bit about some of the traditions associated with the warrior and how we work with this archetype in our own lives.
Yeah, so I would say the warrior is really the embodiment of spirituality through action, or discovering one's own inner core in the midst of chaos, finding that calm in the storm within oneself. And, you know, the warrior has been influenced by spirituality. Obviously, the samurai, for example, were influenced by, particularly by Zen Buddhism. In the West, you have the berserkers who are dedicated to the god Odin. And then, of course, later on with the Christian crusades, you know, you have the crusaders who are devoted to Jesus as well, leaving aside all politics, you know, because very few things are really 100% pure or ideal. But, you know, the warrior has had its various spiritual traditions across the globe, and has in turn affected spirituality and religion. And of course, in various religious texts, we find this idea of the warrior, or the spiritual warrior, or the angel that is fighting a spiritual battle, the war in heaven. You know, St. Michael, for example, in the Bible, waging war against Satan, casting him out of heaven. Well, again, you have the berserkers, but you also have this notion in the Norse religion of this war at the end of time between the gods, Odin, and so on, and their enemies, the giants. And of course, in Islam, most controversially perhaps, but nevertheless, you know, it's relevant. You have this idea of the lesser jihad, or the lesser struggle, being the physical war against the one's enemies. And you have the idea of the Akbar jihad, or the greater jihad, which is the struggle within oneself. And that's kind of what all of these different traditions are driving at as well. You know, even in the martial arts, or among the samurai, in this sort of martial Zen tradition, you very much have this idea that martial arts aren't just about being able to defeat the opponent. They're really essentially about defeating one's own inner opponent. And of course, we're all our own worst enemies and our own worst opponents in many respects. And you know, often in life, we go to different situations having already defeated ourselves by thinking defeatist thoughts or so on. But looking more at the mythology of the warrior, one episode in the Bhagavad Gita that I've always been particularly struck by, perhaps because it does seem to be so contrasting with Christianity as we often think about it. And it's an episode where Krishna and his disciple Arjuna are on the battlefield, and the enemy has arranged itself before them, and on the opposing side are many of Arjuna's uncles and cousins. And he complains to Krishna, who is the Godhead, that he doesn't want to fight. And Krishna says, no, you must fight. The worst thing in the world is to be thought of as a coward. And it's at that moment on the battlefield that Krishna decides to reveal his celestial form. And he reveals his form, and he has millions of arms and legs and millions of heads, and his eyes are the sun and moon, and within his torso, there's the whole of the cosmos is revolving, and life and death is sort of churning within him. And so, you know, in a sense, he is everything and what's beyond the physical cosmos or whatever, however large it might be, or the multiverse. He's beyond that, but that's his physical form in a sense. But you know, what's so intriguing about that, it's not in some sleepy desert place or a cave somewhere or in a temple or in a church or in a peaceful natural environment that the Godhead Krishna decides to reveal himself. It's in the midst of battle. They're on the battlefield, and that's when he decides to reveal it. And you know, perhaps that's because, you know, life itself is a battle, as Marcus Aurelius said, life is warfare. And you know, what Krishna does say, which is you know, again, it could be totally misconstrued by people today. And Krishna says, when you go into battle and you're, you know, cutting down the enemy, he says, don't worry, because it's really me who is cutting them down. You're just my instrument. And, you know, they may sound barbaric, but at the same time, the message is, of course, partly that we're all going to die, and life is always in this sort of constant churn, but at the essence of it all, and within oneself, the essence of one's being is actually the God itself, and our actions can manifest the deity, as it were. And you know, you find this notion, or at least this connection between spirituality and the martial arts and war in, you know, across the globe. So obviously the most famous would be Shaolin Kung Fu, but which is influenced by Buddhism, of course.
Tell us a little bit about Shaolin Kung Fu.
Yeah, so Shaolin Kung Fu, it's often thought to be a couple of thousand years old. It's actually not as old as that. It's a few hundred years old. Although there was, you know, there was a Shaolin temple that was older, and they may have had some sort of martial training or some kind of martial technique, but not as we understand it. It was around the 1600s, I believe, when it really began to transform. And the monks began to develop the styles of kung fu that we think of today, and branching out from there, you get a tai chi and styles of martial arts that are more influenced by Taoism. And another significant influence is not just Buddhism, maybe a little bit of Taoism and martial arts, but it's also the introduction of things which were associated with Taoist inner alchemy and healing. So most notably the, you know, the pressure points, and within Taoist alchemy, inner alchemy, there's also a notion of the chakras as well. So you get this notion of inner energy that's eventually incorporated into Kung Fu and Shaolin Kung Fu. So even today in many kung fu schools, they still have this notion of qi or inner energy, and some schools might take it more literally than others, but you know, it's still a part of that tradition. And you have connections between spirituality or religion in martial arts elsewhere in India, the martial art of Kalari Payat, which looks a lot like a very energetic form of Kung Fu. There they have traditionally in the Kalari Payat martial arts temple, there's an altar with a statue of the goddess Kali on it. And in Iran, the traditional martial art of Zarqana was extremely influenced by Shiite Sufi Islam as well. And the performances of Zarqana wrestlers are strongly influenced by Sufi ritual as well. So even when they might do a performance of repetitive movements like laying on their back or lifting up a very, very heavy wooden shield over and over again, and the way that it would be counted would not be a 1, 2, 3. It was each number that is counted out relates to the Islamic religion or faith. So the number one might be God is one, and number two is God is not two, and then the numbers throughout might refer to different aspects of the religion. Like the number 12 might refer to the 12 imams of Shiite Islam, and so on.
Free Dreamlanders, as always, I'd like to thank you for being with us. Angel's book is Three Stages of Initiatic Spirituality, Craftsman, Warrior, Magician. That's Angel Millar, M-I-L-L-A-R. Do go on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever you buy books and get a copy. And if you shop at an independent bookstore, go to their website. You might find that they are very much in business and ready to serve you. And do seriously consider subscribing to Unknown Country and Dreamland at this time. We need you very, very much.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.